You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, April 26, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dwight, professor of law at Columbia Law School, Jamal Green, author of How Rights Went Wrong, Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart. Meanwhile, India at a crisis point. U.S. administration reverses, will supply material support for the Indian government and allow for export of vaccine materials. EU to allow vaccinated U.S. tourists this summer. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine has been unpaused. Meanwhile, in Washington, Warren, Sanders, and 14 other senators call for expanded Medicare. But it appears Joe Biden will instead seek permanent expansion of ACA subsidies. Supreme Court to hear a major Second Amendment case, which could essentially wipe out any anti-gun legislation. The key witness in the Derek Chauvin defense, a former medical examiner, is now having his former police killing cases reviewed. Texas Republicans have aimed their voter suppression at cities. Biden administration extends free lunches for students until June 2022. Meanwhile, progressives lose in Louisiana congressional primary, and that seat to replace Cedric Richmond. And lastly, Joe Biden formally recognizes the Armenian genocide. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Joining me as always, Emma Vigeland. Emma, how are you? Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. I have a bit of a case of the Mondays, but you know, as soon as we start talking politics, it'll shake right off.
Yes,
well,
I have a little
technically
bit.
We all have the case of the Mondays.
Yes, it's
Monday.
Going around. It's definitely going around.
Right, but I'm special, so
you have the special case of the Mondays. Mine is mixed in with allergies. We got a lot to talk about today. Just want to point out that story about the Chauvin defense witness. If you have the Peacock app, you can watch it. If you don't have the Peacock app, it's quite easy to get the Peacock app. And in the Emma and I do a series of interviews for a second hour exclusively on Peacock. It's free. And it is, I interviewed two reporters, J.D. Duggan and Samantha Hendrickson, about this David Fowler a couple of weeks ago. They had dug into his record and found that there was all sorts of, well, there was a lawsuit going on by the family of, I believe the man's name was Anton Walker. And this guy Fowler, who was Maryland's chief medical examiner for about 17 years, I think it was like 2002 to 2019. He had many cases where he found police officers not responsible for the deaths of people who died in their custody. And apparently all these cases are being reviewed. It was great reporting. You should check that out. J.D. Duggan, Samantha Hendrickson, two reporters who were wrote in the for The Intercept, but they write, I think, for the University of Minnesota paper, and they did an amazing job. You should check that out. Meanwhile, we have a horrible situation in India. Over 350,000 new COVID infections as of yesterday. Many people believe that these numbers are actually less than the reality. Narendra Modi, right-wing, I think some would say fascistic leader of India.
Certainly a fascist, I would say, you know.
Has botched this dramatically. They were doing well, and then they basically relaxed too early. And there's virtually no vaccination happening. And I mean, it's a massive country, obviously, over a billion in terms of population. And it is a very desperate situation in India. And meanwhile, just the other day, we were talking to Ann Newman about vaccinations. I did an interview the other day about specifically Bill Gates's role in the IP of vaccinations, but also his, broadly speaking, his role in public health in the world. And this is this is a perfect example of a problem that comes from having billionaires walking amongst us, is that their desire to engage based upon their own self-estimation is there is no bar to entry for them because they have so much money. So if I walk around and I think to myself, you know what? I know how to manage the Celtics, better than the general manager of the Celtics, and I have billions of dollars. I just go buy it and the Celtics, and I have my way with it. Now, that's all well and good for a basketball team. But the problem is that some of these people also think, you know what? I have good ideas about health policy, even though I have no history, no experience in health policy. So I'm going to dump a couple of billion dollars into that field. And no one is going to criticize me because so many of them are upstream from my revenue. Or I should say downstream from my revenue.
Well, he has a God complex to put it succinctly.
I'm perfectly fine with God complexes. The problem is that when someone has so much money, they can act on these things. He destroyed U.S. education for nearly two decades. And at the end of that run, his own commission study said, yeah, your experiment was wrong. And folks can look up the Rand Corporation's assessment of the Gates's education initiative. And we still have high stakes testing because of it. We still have attacks on and a desire to privatize our education. Very problematic. And it is a well-known story now that Oxford University was developing their vaccine and were going to disseminate this wildly. They were going to open source this vaccine. They had done something similar, I guess, Oxford University during World War II. I can't remember exactly what it was that they were fighting at the time. And Bill Gates stepped in, convinced them, you need to sell this to a private company and not open source this. The IP, the intellectual property of the development of this vaccine, what's involved with it, needs to be behind a paywall. And as such, we do not have wide production of these vaccines. Here's Bill Gates being asked on Sky News in Britain this question. There's no follow-up because, of course, you don't question this guy, despite the fact that his only bona fides at this point for public health is that he had a lot of money.
did very little to prepare in advance.
And in terms of that, there's been some speculation that the changing intellectual property rules and allowing these vaccines, as you say, the recipe for these vaccines to be shared would be helpful. And do you think that would be helpful?
No.
Why not?
Well, there's only so many vaccine factories in the world, and people are very serious about the safety of vaccines. And so moving something that had never been done, moving a vaccine from, say, a J&J factory into a factory in India, that it's novel. It's only because of our grants and our expertise that can happen at all. The thing that's holding things back in this case is not intellectual property. There's not like some idle vaccine factory with regulatory approval that makes magically safe vaccines. You know, you've got to do the trials on these things, and every manufacturing process has to be looked at in a very careful way. There's all sorts of issues around intellectual property having to do with medicines, but not in terms of how quickly we've been able to ramp up the volume here. You know, I remember how shocked people were when we said we were going to do second sources in these developing country factories. You know, that was a novel thing. We got all the rights from the vaccine companies. They didn't hold it back. They were participating. I do a regular phone call with the pharmaceutical CEOs to make sure that work is going at full speed.
So, oh, good.
Yeah. Now, there's a couple of things here that are just ludicrous. First off, the idea that he cited the Johnson & Johnson factory. That factory is essentially completely useless now. It is in the United States. It is in Baltimore. It has been under FDA purview. And it has basically shut down the Johnson & Johnson production.
They poisoned up to over 15 million doses.
At the very least.
Weird, weird example to choose, as you say.
And so the idea that there's something unique about vaccine companies in the United States is absurd. It's absurd. You have, in addition, the CEO of that vaccine maker sold $10 million in stock before his company, at least reportedly, ruined those vaccines. So that factory is basically shut down. This is something that we could have been anticipated. The idea that you cannot get a factory up and running to make vaccines in India, let's say, he used that example, with the year in advance notice that we had is absurd.
And India, as an example, is, you know, to use that also is a terrible example because they are the world's, I think, number one vaccine manufacturer in terms of the facilities that they have set up there.
It's absurd. Of course, there's the ability to do this. This story from Nature, the key bottleneck in the mRNA vaccine manufacturer is a worldwide shortage of essential components, especially nucleotides, enzymes, and lipids. This is because relatively few companies make these products, and not in sufficient numbers for global supply. Moreover, these companies are proving slow to license their manufacturing so that others could do that. That's the intellectual property. For example, every RNA strand requires a cap that prevents the human body from rejecting it as foreign material. It's the most expensive component, and the intellectual property rights for a popular cap design are held by one company, TriLink Biotechnologies, based in San Diego, California. It's absurd. And the idea that Bill Gates, self-appointed now czar of the world's health policy, we are supposed to be comforted by the fact that he is talking to the CEOs of these private companies whose job number one is profits. Period. End of story. That is their job number one. And I would say, to the extent that that's even debatable, job number one would be their own personal enrichment and then profits. Usually those go hand in hand, although we've seen examples during the plenty in the past that hasn't. All right, we got to take a quick break and we'll be back in just a moment with Jamal Green, Dwight Professor of Law from Columbia Law School, author of How Rights Went Wrong, Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart. Folks, a couple of sponsors on today's program. As you know, I am sartorially challenged. Shopping is very difficult for me. I don't like going into stores to do it. Obviously, during COVID, I'm not a big fan of that. But even then, even before then, I think I was scarred as a kid because I would go into this place in Worcester and I was forced into wearing Husky clothes. But nevertheless, they literally had Husky on the label. Now I found an easier way to shop, a better way, Stitch Fix. It does all the hard work for you. Stitch Fix offers clothing hand-selected by expert stylists for your unique size, for your style, for your budget, whatever it is. All of these pieces are chosen based upon what you like. And what you're allowed to do, they send it to you. You try it on at home before you buy. You keep what you love and you send back what you don't like. Stitch Fix has free shipping. They have easy returns. They have super easy exchanges. They include a prepaid envelope in your fix, they call it. There's no subscription required. There's a $20 fee for the stylist, but that you get to apply to any of the pieces of clothing you keep. They have Stitch Fix has styles and clothing for women, for men, for kids, for everybody. They ship all over the US and available in the UK as well. You folks have heard hopefully about my modern leather. The shoe, sort of like a desert boot. I'm going to start kicking those out as we all start to, you know, the summer when you've been vaxxed, you go out. I'm looking forward to maybe having like a dinner at a restaurant or at least an outdoor dinner at a restaurant. And I've been wearing my Nashville 5-pocket straight fit pants. Those things have basically switched me to a 5-pocket pant now. Like it's put me on the 5-pocket pant level. And my daughter has stolen my flannel shirt. It was easy. It was fun. And now I spend a lot of time on Stitch Fix just liking or disliking clothes so that it gets they figure out what I like better. You can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.com/majority. Also, today's program sponsored by Third Love. Third Love uses the measurements of millions of women to design bras with all-day comfort and support. Each bra made with signature memory foam cups, no slip straps, and scratch-free band. Now, of course, I associate Third Love with my daughter sending me texts all the time. Can I get some more Third Love bras? That's basically what she says. And somehow, I don't know what she does with these things, but I'm like, how many bras do you need? But she loves them. And it's basically because apparently I'm not a bra wearer myself, but apparently very difficult to buy bras online because it's hard to get them to fit right. Well, they have a fitting room quiz. It focuses on size, on shape, and current fit issues, and your personal style. And they Third Love delivers bras and underwear that are perfect for you. It's better than a traditional bra fitting experience because you can do it from the comfort of your home. From loungewear to wireless styles to their number one rated 24/7 classic t-shirt bra, Third Love is changing the game when it comes to comfort and style. You can check out Lounge by Third Love to find the ultimate loungewear in premium cotton fabrics available in drapey knits, 100% cotton, French terry, and woven styles. Here is our official, one of our official Third Love bra triers. The idea that I had 60 days to try out the bras drew me in, but in the end, I don't think I've ever had a better experience buying clothing online, certainly not when it comes to bras. The fit finder worked like a charm. The choice of styles, amazing. Both the bras I ordered were the perfect fit. They're incredibly comfortable and cute and subtle. Third Love knows your one true fit is out there. So right now they're offering my listeners 20% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 20% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 20% off. And lastly, this is one of Emma's favorites. It's Liquid IV. Are you? I'm almost done with my.
I got some Liquid IV right in here right now.
My
acai, my favorite one.
Is that how you say that?
Yeah, and that I've said this, and you've also then said, "Is that how you say that?"
I get this. I'm losing my memory, but Liquid IV has created Hydration Multiplier plus immune support to maintain and strengthen your immune system. Today, I am doing the energy one, but I've been mixing it back and forth a little bit. Hydration Multiplier plus immune support is a cutting edge blend of vitamin C, zinc, and Wellmune in convenient single serving packets to help strengthen your immune system. The blend is powered by cellular transport technology, which is designed to enhance rapid absorption of water and other nutrients. Each packet is bursting with fresh, natural tangerine flavor. It tastes really good. I switched that up with my green tea matcha, it has caffeine of 2 cups of coffee, the energy one. But all of the Liquid IVs can provide 2 to 3 times more hydration than water alone. And with every purchase, Liquid IV donates a serving of Liquid IV to someone in need. The company has donated over 10 million servings globally, including over 4 million servings in response to COVID-19. When I used to travel, I would take a bunch of these with me for traveling, for jet lag. And when I'm overindulging occasionally, which happens rarely, but it happens. I hydrate myself both at night and in the morning. Good as new. And I have gotten rid of coffee and have just basically replaced it with the Energy Liquid IV. All of the ingredients are just much better than some of the junky chemical ones you get in other those like energy drinks. And now you can get your Liquid IV's Hydration Multiplier plus immune support in bulk at Costco, or you can order online and get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code Majority Report at checkout. Use the code Majority Rep, not Majority Report, at checkout. That's 25% off anything when you get better hydration today using promo code Majority Rep at liquidiv.com. Okay. I'd like to welcome to the program Dwight Professor of Law, Jamal Green. He is from Columbia University Law School and has just come out with a new book. It is How Rights Went Wrong, Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart. Professor, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Hi, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you start off with a history of how our, I guess, rights regime in this country developed. Didn't really necessarily come from the Constitution. I mean, let's start there and then go into the Lochner era.
Sure. And the book is really about reconciling the way we think about rights, which tends to be in pretty absolutist terms, with living in a pluralistic society. And a lot of times we, especially when I make this argument, I see people then invoke the framers and say, you know, rights are absolute and rights are Trump's because the framers made it so. And that's really not true. The way we think about rights as being at least presumptively absolute would have been not only foreign to a lot of the ways the members of the founding generation thought about rights, but mortifying to them insofar as we end up delegating to judges the power to decide our rights for us. And the way that the founding generation thought about it, they took rights very seriously, but they thought about rights as something that communities get together to create and to decide on the limits of, right? So when we think about the Bill of Rights, a lot of the Bill of Rights is actually about empowering self-government, into empowering juries, empowering legislatures, even the militia, which was a form of policing, right? So empowering communities to govern themselves and set the limits of their rights. When we think about the Declaration of Independence, which talks about the unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, they weren't saying, and therefore we got to get judges to come in and say when those rights are activated and when they aren't. The very next sentence of the Declaration is, and that's why governments are instituted among men, is what they say, because the idea being that you get your rights from community negotiation, community deliberation, and we've lost that, and it's a long story for why we've lost that, but we shouldn't tie that idea to the founding generation.
Right, and so I guess this is a good time to also to expand on when we say rights. I mean, there are different types of rights, right? I mean, both rights, negative and positive rights, subscribe to perceiving them that way. But when we talk about rights, and when you're examining the development of these rights, just explain to us the nature of those rights. Just generally, are we talking about individual rights, or is that the development that is rather novel?
Well, in a lot of ways, I'm trying to get away from the idea that when we resolve legal disputes, that the way we resolve those disputes is to decide who has a right and who doesn't have a right. That's the kind of polarizing, and I think in a lot of ways destructive frame that we tend to use. When there are a lot of different philosophical conceptions of what rights are, you know, you can go and take a philosophy course and figure that out, right? But when it comes down to a legal decision maker, whether it's a judge or through the political process, resolving a conflict between people, it's usually not the case that the most constructive way of resolving that conflict is to say one side has a right and the other side doesn't have a right. Usually it's much more kind of brass tacks. What I say in the book is we need to resolve these kinds of conflicts at retail rather than at wholesale, which is to say someone's got a right on one side and someone's got a right on the other side. Someone's passed a law, a public health measure, a public safety law. That's trying to protect rights as much as the person who feels victimized by that law is trying to protect rights, right? So rights are in both sides of lots of disputes that we have. And it's very easy. I'm a law professor. It's very easy for me to construct an argument for why the Constitution protects the rights on both sides of just about every conflict we have. And so saying who has a right or who doesn't get us very far. And what we need to do much more of is thinking about, well, why did the government pass this law? What alternative might there have been? Who's burdened, who isn't burdened? How far, you know, you've got to make a judgment call about a lot of these things. And we've gotten away from that. And we feel as though we've got to sort of assign a constitutional right to one side or the other. These are retail political conflicts that we have about our rights. They're not metaphysical existential crises.
Well, I mean, that undercuts, I feel like, so much of how judges view themselves, right? I mean, there's so much judicial activism that takes place. I know you write about some of that. Can you talk about how this perception of rights, I guess, makes conflicts or disputes susceptible to kind of judges looking at things through their specific lens and tailoring them in a bit of an activist way?
Well, I hesitate to use the word activist because it's so politically charged. Sure. And one person's activist is another person's, you know, constitutionalist or something. But I do think, you know, to the extent that what that gets at is a kind of self-aggrandizement by judges, right? Judges feel like they are the ones who decide our rights for us. I do think that the tendency that I'm trying to criticize in the book does lead to that, right? So let's say there's a dispute about the First Amendment or about a political ad, right? Or a political, so Citizens United, which we all remember at least the name of that case, which is about an ideological corporation that wants to run an anti-Hillary Clinton movie right before the 2008 election. we frame that, lawyers frame that, the public frames that as a First Amendment case. It's a free speech case. Do corporations have free speech rights becomes the question. Judges understand themselves within our system as the ones who answer that question, and they answer it by looking at precedent, looking at the text of the Constitution, looking at maybe thinking about what the framers thought. These are kind of legalistic ways of answering those kinds of questions. They're, judges are essentially justifying their own authority by saying the way we resolve a dispute about a Hillary Clinton movie is by referring to text, history, precedent, lawyerly things, because why else would judges be the ones resolving these conflicts? There's no reason why that has to happen unless you commit yourself to an overly legalistic culture. So what's the other way of thinking about a conflict like Citizens United? It's to say, well, yes, there's a speech right at issue here. There's a corporation that an ideological corporation wants to engage in speech. There's also a political equality issue here because the government's passed a campaign finance law that's trying to equalize citizen access to the political process. So you've got constitutionally important rights on both sides of that dispute. Instead of thinking of it as do corporations have free speech rights? Let's think of, well, are ideological corporations different from General Motors or someone who makes widgets? What is the precise burden on a company on Citizens United, where the in the case itself, it was actually about whether they had to set up a separate political action committee versus using their general treasury funds to spend money on this ad? How burdensome is that? Right. Those kinds of questions are not the kinds of questions the court answered. And in some ways, I think that's linked to the self-conception of judges as trying to decide our rights for us. And that's, I think, terribly destructive.
How would, and I want to get back to that sort of that the Lochner case where this sort of I think you peg this as sort of developing, but how would how would, though, just to use your example, how would lower courts be able to address these issues? I mean, I am of the mind that the judges are doing exactly what you're saying. It's just that they, in certain instances, they don't necessarily decide in the way I want to, and they're dressing it up in some type of framework so that these future questions can be answered. But I mean, is it possible to have looked at every single case in its specifics, or don't you need some type of principle, legal principle, to maintain the architecture of the legal system? I mean, I got to say, I'm skeptical as to the sincerity of that architecture, but that is like the pretense, isn't it?
So it's a fair question, and there's a couple of questions embedded in there. So one is about precedent and how do you sort of maintain precedent in the, we think that judges have to figure out what the rules are, right? And those rules are going to be overbroad and generalizable, and that gives advice to the lower courts. And then there's a separate question here about sincerity and about, is this all just kind of a game? And if you're just kind of, you know, shifting the deck chairs around, does that really change anything? As to the first, I think it's really a matter of what kinds of questions does a court ask when they receive a case. Precedent can mean when I see a case like Citizens United, I've got to figure out what does the First Amendment mean? And that's an interpretive question. So you might look at the text, you might look at particular precedents around what is the scope of your free speech right? The other way of looking at this is to say, to ask a different kind set of questions. So what kind of law is this? What was the evidence on which this law was based? What are the purposes behind this law? What are the alternatives available? Those kinds of questions can also generate a set of precedents around the facts of the dispute. So it's different ways about thinking about facts. Well, what are the relevant pieces of information that I need to solve this kind of case? And I'm trying to urge that information to be based on facts in the real world, as opposed to being based on legal abstractions. So on the second point, does this really affect, you know, I'll just crudely characterize your question as, is this going to change any, does this affect any outcomes? If it's just a matter of, you know, judges are just going to reach out, they're going to reach the same result anyway. And, you know, you're just urging them to dress it up differently. And that's a fair criticism. And I'm not suggesting necessarily that in all of the hot button disputes that we have, that outcomes will come out differently. I do think that what I'm trying to urge is the conversation that cases generate to focus on a different set of questions. So just to go back to that Citizens United example, you know, if I'm left of center, right? If you ask me, do you believe in corporate speech rights or do you believe in political equality? Right? I'm going to say, I believe in political equality. You ask someone right of center that question, they might very well answer it differently. And so that, in that way, that the case just recreates the same kind of ideological disputes that we have. But if you ask me, should an ideological corporation be able to use its general treasury funds to fund a video on demand movie that so people only get it if they ask for it, in the weeks leading up to an election where they're criticizing one of the candidates, you know, I might be able to go for that. and so might my right of center friend, right? So there are ways in which we can dial down, depending on the kinds of questions we ask, dial down some of the conflict that we have around, we can talk about where we have consensus and where we don't. We might still reach different judgments in cases, of course. We're all different people, right? But there are ways in which judges and other legal decision makers can help with dialing down the temperature of political conflict, and there are ways they can hurt. And I think right now they're hurting.
I want to circle back to that premise, which is the central premise of the book. But let's go to the Lochner case, where you cite that case as being sort of, I guess, the beginning of the development of this notion of I don't know if it's the beginning of the development, but it's really when it starts to sort of come to the fore in terms of the development of rights on some level.
So sure. Yeah. So the Lochner case, and I don't know how familiar your audience will be with this case. It's one of these things that all lawyers know, but most non-lawyers don't know.
Well, they should be, but we'll see.
But it's a very important case where New York passes a law that says that you can't work more than 10 hours a day or 60 hours a week in a bake shop, and passes unanimously in the New York legislature. It's a health and safety measure and a labor law. The Supreme Court strikes it down. And this case is understood as sort of standing in for an era of, I'll go back to Emma's word, judicial activism, where judges are reaching out to, you know, apply their ideological lens to the sort of laissez-faire economics ideological lens to lawmaking. And within the legal culture of the United States in the middle of the 20th century and beyond, we think of that case as being just egregiously wrongly decided. Every member of the Supreme Court today will say that the Lochner decision is wrongly decided. And
is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
I worry. I mean, there's some, right? I mean, don't we have to let's put it this way. Not as vociferously as maybe the Supreme Court 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35.
Yeah, yeah, that's ago. I think that's fair. And there are certainly elements of the conservative legal movement that would not say that Lochner is wrongly decided. I think that they haven't made it to that group hasn't quite made it to the Supreme Court. And so it's still a mainstream position, I'll say, that Lochner is the worst of the worst. And conservatives and liberals tend to pick at different parts of it. But what it does in our history is it sets out one strand of thinking about rights. And opposition to Lochner ends up taking the form of when the government is engaged in certain kinds of social and economic legislation, you just let them do it. Because if you don't let them do it, you're going to be making lots of judgment calls in the way that the Lochner court did. And Lochner court is wrong. And so we should give deference to the government. But there's, of course, another strand that says when rights are at stake, of course you don't give deference to the government. And that strand is the Jim Crow strand, right? So middle of the 20th century, Brown versus Board of Education, you don't trust the government at all, right? So we have these two competing notions of rights in our head that results from just the baggage of American history. One of which says you defer entirely to legislatures, and the other of which says you defer not at all to legislatures. And what ends up happening in the 1960s and 1970s is you get a lot more rights cases that don't fit comfortably in either of those categories, right? So you get a birth control law or a law that where someone's challenging the government taking away their welfare, or someone's trying to burn a draft card and in protest of the Vietnam War, and that's being criminalized. So do you defer entirely to the government because the government should always be able to, you know, penalize to decide on people's welfare rights, however they want, or do you defer not at all to the government because important rights are at stake? Well, it's going to be somewhere in the middle. And we never really constructed a language for dealing with the mine run of rights cases, which are between the extremes of no deference to the government at all and complete deference to the government.
So I'm just trying to understand that. Like in the Lochner case, the idea was that the Supreme Court was saying that the right to enter into a contract needs to be is sacrosanct and can't be impeded by government. And then in Jim Crow, you have people saying that is it really just a question of like whether or not you defer to the government, or is it that, well, the basis in which, in Jim Crow, for instance, you know, we have a whole series of amendments that came out through Reconstruction to the Constitution that the Constitution trumps. It seems to me far more explicit in terms of rolling back Jim Crow laws than it would in protecting the sacrosanctness of contract. I mean, isn't that isn't that what that comes down to? I mean, aren't you flattening these a little bit? Is just a response to I should or should not defer to the government, or is your argument that that's what happened, that it was flattened?
So my argument is that that's what happened, is that it ended up being flattened in that way, even though rights are much more contextual than that. So a couple of things on what you said. So one is the way to think about Jim Crow versus Lochner just a matter of what's explicit? I think not. I think both of those are 14th Amendment cases, and the 14th Amendment doesn't, at least Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, doesn't mention race at all. And the people who wrote the Lochner case thought they were interpreting that same amendment in that same section as the people who as the Brown court. Now, I of course think Brown is rightly decided, and I think Lochner is wrongly decided. But I don't think that the reason why one is rightly decided and one is wrongly decided is one involved rights and the other one didn't. I think they both involve rights. I think the right to contract is a right that people have and should have, and it's very easy to specify it constitutionally. But it just doesn't go nearly as far as the Lochner court thought it went. And that's in fact what the Lochner court said. It didn't quite say that the right was sacrosanct. It said it depends on whether the government has good reasons or not. And there were two dissenting opinions, and one of them said, well, yeah, that's right. There is a right to contract, and it just depends on whether the government has good reasons or not. But I think the government did have good reasons. That's Justice Harlan's dissent in Lochner. The much more famous dissent is Justice Holmes's dissent, where he basically says, no, there is no right to contract. This is a silly case. And that dissent ends up being the one that kind of defines that strand of rights thinking in the United States. For lots of, again, historically contingent reasons having to do with Felix Frankfurter being a Holmes acolyte and kind of distributing pro-Holmes views to all of his disciples. But that's the way legal education ends up working. And when we get to the 1960s, everyone's running away from the idea that you can have kind of rights that aren't complete, right? The right to contract, which Justice Harlan would have said, yeah, this is a right, but it's limited. That language of this is a right, but it's limited, ends up sort of not having any traction in U.S. constitutional law. It does have lots of traction elsewhere in the world. And I think, and there are a number of comparative examples in the book, I think quite productively has a lot of traction elsewhere in the world. And what it comes down to is, look, when you live in a complex pluralistic society, everyone can't have absolute rights, right? So because they're going to conflict all the time. And so you have to decide, you know, either everyone kind of has partial rights that are kind of resolved, mediated is the word I use in the book, or you have to decide who has rights and who doesn't. And we've ended up picking the latter, and that's really polarizing. And I think it's not something that judges, going back to Emma's question, it ends up giving judges an awful lot of power over who ends up being a rights holder. It's one thing to have power over who wins this case, but power over who gets to be a rights holder is power that judges should not have.
And so let's talk about that proportionality analysis and this idea of reconciling rights and how it plays out in other countries. You write about Germany, particularly in the context of abortion rights. Walk us through that. And also, I'm curious as to whether it's because they have a fundamentally different legal system in the way that just even like plaintiffs come to the court or defendants, and the way that the judges perceive, you know, they don't have necessarily the same sort of adversarial qualities necessarily that we do. Walk us through that?
Sure. There are a number of different comparative examples. And Germany, as you mentioned, there's a whole chapter on German abortion jurisprudence, which I can say something about. But Canada is also an example that I refer to a number of times. And the Canadian legal system is pretty similar to the U.S. legal system in terms of how cases are brought, the structure of the Supreme Court, the structure of lower courts. And sometimes when I make this argument, you know, people worry about chaos, right? And Canada is not a chaotic legal system. I mean, they work it out. So anytime, if part of the concern is, you know, the German system is too far from ours, well, there's also Canada. So the Germany case, I talk a bit about abortion rights, and I'm always, you know, try to be cautious when I talk about this issue, and particularly whether we can make progress on this issue. I don't know if we can. Right. So the chapter means to say, look, there was a moment in the 1970s when there were some choices that courts could make about how to structure abortion rights jurisprudence. And German courts, and courts in a number of other places as well, but German courts in particular, made a choice to say, we're gonna think about rights being on both sides of this dispute, right? So the Constitution protects the value of fetal life, and that's a very important, I'll call it a right, they wouldn't use quite that word, but protects the value of fetal life, and it also protects the autonomy of women. And so the way this dispute has to be resolved is in a way that respects both of those. The government has to respect both of those. And what ends up happening is that the political conversation in the German context responds to that by arriving at a consensus topic of conversation that responds to both of those things, which is, how do you give women more genuine choices? Right. So if you are from the anti-abortion rights side and someone says you've got to respect women's autonomy, they say, well, how about we respect women's autonomy by making sure that abortion restrictions don't arrive till the second trimester, for example. So you've got basically liberalized abortion access in the first trimester, but the second trimester, you need to have a particular reason. And from the other side, the pro abortion rights side, well, you know, we think that the way that if you're going to restrict abortion rights, you've got to make sure that women are actually given genuine choice, right? So do they have prenatal care, right? Do they have postnatal care? Do they have child care? Do they have employment guarantees? If you want to save the life of a fetus, right, the way to save the life of a fetus is not to restrict abortion. That's going to lead the practice underground, right? The way to save the life of a fetus is to make a woman make a different choice, or to incentivize her to make a different choice, to make her life easier as a parent. And so there's a grand compromise, political compromise, spurred on by court decisions around, and people with very different views about abortion rights, construct a regime. And the regime is, you know, pretty liberal access in the first trimester, funding for people who have trouble paying for abortion access, which isn't a thing at all in the U.S. In the second trimester, it's an indications model, right? So So if there's a medical reason or a health reason, or then you can get a so-called indicated abortion. Look, lots of people are not going to like that regime, but lots of people are going to think it should be more liberalized. Lots of people are going to think it should be less liberalized. But the point of the chapter is to say that the court decisions spurred a political solution, so that and vastly lowered the temperature of the issue, so that in the 1970s, abortion was a more controversial topic in Germany than it was in the United States in the early 1970s. And today it's not even, they're two different universes. And it's, you can trace ways in which court decisions contributed to that. Roe versus Wade happens the same time as that German case that I referred to, more or less the same time. But there the court insists that we can't think of fetal life as having any constitutional value, because if we did, and since we think of rights in this sort of almost absolute sort of way, then that would mean that the women can't possibly have their own abortion rights. The court doesn't have the imagination to think of those things as coexisting. And that actually ends up fairly directly dividing the anti-abortion movement between people who were much more moderate forces within that movement in the early 1970s. And they get kind of kicked out of the movement by much more extreme activists who call for constitutional amendments and changing the court and all sorts of things. So it's not to say that, it's such a polarizing issue today, right, that it's hard to know exactly what to do with it, but it's to say there were other options, and there's some evidence that those options led to a much more productive way of thinking about this issue.
Does this conception of rights, I guess, I mean, it I think allows for judicial power to be more ubiquitous, as you're getting at, and that then it necessarily needs to be in the United States. And it's almost like we're, you know, with this new conception of rights that you're laying out, it's kind of asking judges to relinquish some sort of discretion and power that they seem to wield, I think, with more enthusiasm than perhaps you'd like. I'm just trying to see how they could adjust their perspective, because them, you know, behaving in this way, it kind of suits their power interests, does it not, this conception?
Well, in a sense, I mean, I think how the power plays out, you know, one of the lines in the book is, you know, judges should recognize more rights, but they should be less strong, right? So they should be more willing to say there are rights at stake here, but less willing to say that means that resolves the case, because the case will get resolved in other ways. There are ways of characterizing that as judges grabbing more power, right? And I think sometimes the argument is characterized that way. Sam mentioned positive rights earlier in the conversation. This way of thinking is much more open to the possibility of positive rights, so right to health or right to education, right? There might be circumstances under which it makes sense for courts to step in and say, you know, the state doesn't have a good enough reason for not providing this vital resource to people. I talk about from the 1970s, a well-known case out of San Antonio involving the use of property tax, local property taxes, to fund local schools, where there's an equal protection and equality challenge and a right to education challenge brought against that. And it loses. And part of the reason it loses is the judges say it's 5-4 case. Lewis Powell, who writes the majority opinion, just says, look, we can't, you know, he's a big anti-communist, right? He says, look, this would be communism. Like, we can't have equality of all the positive resources that are provided by the government. And so therefore that must not be a right, right? And what I want to say is that kind of reasoning, you know, you can say that something's a right, but also say that doesn't mean that the courts are going to order the government to provide it absolutely and to everyone. You know, these schools were, you know, sort of manifestly unequal, and there are ways of making them more equal. And, you know, judges have to do what they can within their resources to help that. So in that sense, whether they're getting more power or not sort of depends on the case and depends on how we're thinking about their power. I want their power to be continuous with political power, which is to say, the kinds of things that judges are talking about should be the same kinds of things that politicians are talking about when they talk about the resources available to particular schools in a case like the San Antonio case. What I worry about is judges converting what is actually a political dispute on which they have a role to play, right? They can set the bounds of that politics, but converting that political dispute into a question of like, where are the commas in the Constitution, which is not what the dispute is about. That's an abstraction.
Is there a chicken and egg? I'm curious as to whether this we find ourselves in this dynamic. And I certainly, the idea that these political fights are being turned into sort of more, into argument about rights resonates with me. But is this not by design? I mean, the idea that, I don't think it's, and I understand, abortion is sort of almost a unique issue, but in some ways it's unique because it was meant to be unique. That the reason why it was more contentious in Germany in the 1970s is because there was yet to be, a movement that chose abortion as the sort of vanguard of that movement when it was really ultimately about taxation and being able to segregate your colleges and still get a tax, freedom. You didn't have to pay, a tax as an educational institution. Like, aren't we looking at the product of a political machination rather than a native impulse within judges, but rather the assertion of politics onto our judiciary?
So yes, I mean it's an astute point, and I think it's right to a degree. But what I'd say is politicians are going to politic, right? They're going to be opportunistic. And the abortion story is certainly an example of that. But from my perspective, as a lawyer, as a law professor, as someone who can try to make an intervention from my corner of the world, there are ways of making that opportunism easier and more efficient, and there are ways of making it less efficient. And there's only so much courts can do. I'm not a utopian about courts or someone who thinks that they can solve all our problems, but they can make them worse. And I try to track a lot of ways in which that's happened, both in the 1970s and today, within the book. There are lots of problems with our politics, and there are lots of, and by the way, I'll say, opportunism is inherent in politics, right? It's not something that's always a problem, right? But I'm trying to say what can the legal system do? How can it make things better rather than making things worse? It's not going to solve our problems. How can they shape conversations? Are they leaving money on the table? And I think there are a lot of ways in which they are.
Jamal Green, the author of How Rights Went Wrong, Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart. We'll put a link to your book at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, folks. Going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more after this. Okay, just wrapping things up here. We should get to this last clip, Emma, because there is Joe Biden has come out with or starting to roll out a climate plan, which in many respects, I think people would agree is less than sufficient for what we need. And certainly in terms of executing things, we need to pace this up, folks. And however, the right in this country have deployed a fairly threadbare, but maybe successful tactics in some respect. They have decided that Joe Biden's plan means no more hamburgers, the same thing that they said with the Green New Deal. And Larry Kudlow has got a little twist on it. And here it is.
Of our power. Speaking of stupid, there's a study coming out of the University of Michigan which says that to meet the Biden Green New Deal targets, America has to get this. America has to stop eating meat, stop eating poultry, fish, seafood, eggs, dairy, and animal-based fats. Okay, we got that? No burgers on July 4th. No steaks on the Barbie. I'm sure middle America is just going to love that. Can you grill those Brussels sprouts? So get ready. You can throw back a plant-based beer with your grilled Brussels sprouts and wave your American flag. Call it July 4th Green.
No more meat beer?
I'm making fun of this because I intend to make fun of it. This kind of thinking is stupid.
Okay.
It comes from a bunch of ideological zealots.
Listen, first off, the alcohol content in the meat-laced beer is super high.
This is venison beer.
I was about to say venison. I was trying to think of the grossest meat possible.
The best part about this is he's sitting there, and at least he has the integrity to say, like, this is actually going to be concerning people in the Midwest. Like, because basically, like, God knows the last time he got in front of a barbecue, or for that matter, had a beer ever, that he is also surprised to find out that beer is plant-based, apparently.
Yeah, he definitely seems more like a brown liquor kind of guy. And also, I'm pretty sure that they barbecue on the East Coast and the West Coast as well. And what they're taking this from, by the way, CNN did a fact check, is a Daily Mail article that cited that study that Biden didn't put out himself at all. It's just about meat consumption in regards to climate change, a separate study. And then they're just pinning it to the Biden administration, claiming they said it when they didn't.
Incidentally, and I will also say that Brussels sprouts are awesome. And I imagine that they grow them also in the Midwest, and they're just as awesome in the Midwest as they are here on the East Coast.
You're really going to die on the Brussels sprouts are awesome?
It's actually my favorite vegetable.
Asparagus, broccoli, spinach, all those better, but whatever.
But there it is. Is it? No, he's going to make fun of this because he doesn't want to be drinking any of those.
Get a lamb chop IPA.
All right, we got to go. We'll be back tomorrow for those of you who are leaving us. We'll see you then. And for those of you who are staying, we're going to keep talking like Larry Kudlow for the entire front half of the show. And I'm just going to have some of my, is it my poisson beer is what I'm having today. My fish-based beer. That is really stunning that nobody caught that.
Have you ever heard of Dogfish IPA? You know what's in that?
I don't want to know.
Both dog and fish.
Did no one pick that up at Fox Business? Is there nobody there?
I think when it's Larry Kudlow speaking the way that he talks, you kind of tune out after a while and just assume that he's approximating speech.
Did the boss just say plant-based beer like it was some type of weird thing? I thought hops. It's hops. I thought it was a rabbit. I thought it was rabbit-based beer. I'm I don't know if it's ever occurred to me to grill Brussels sprouts, but I am psyched to do that.
Well, grilling vegetables is good.
Oh, without a doubt. What is the vegetables that you generally grill? Like I've grilled carrots and peppers and
peppers. I feel like is the most frequent. Yeah.
Here's the key.
I like asparagus a lot. I haven't done it. My mom, I don't have a grill in Brooklyn.
I oven roast asparagus.
Asparagus is good to grill. Here's a little tip on the peppers. You grill them without cutting them up. You cut them up afterwards.
Oh.
Yeah. There you go. That's it for the day. That and the fact that beer does not come from any meat-based products. So you should know that. I don't think there's any, I'm not trying to think of like, I can imagine like if someone ever put butter in beer or something, but I don't think so.
Only in Harry Potter.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking about. I got Harry Potter on the mind. That's
Wait, what book is Saul on?
Number five.
Five was my favorite.
It's the darkest one, Matt.
Yeah, that's why I
like
that.
Harry's all moody in that one.
And there's a secret society.
Yeah. The DA, right? That's what they call it. The
Dumbledore's
DA.
Army. Hell yeah. Yeah.
It's cool when you just call it DA, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I just throw it off. It's no biggie. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support not only the free show, you get the free show free of commercials. You also get the fun half. And, we got a Discord now. Kyle said he would stop giving me constant updates on the number of people in there, but it is a lot. I'm trying to see how many people we have in there. I'm going to start to dip in now a little bit when I don't have primary responsibility. There are times where I do not have the children at that point, and then I will dip in. But if you go to majoritydiscord.com, you can sign up and get in on the fun. We have now over 1,600 members, 480 of whom are online as we speak. Head over there. People are talking about the grilled asparagus being wonderful. So there you go. And that's that. So check that out. And don't forget amquickie.com. Get your 6 minutes of headlines, amquickie.com every morning. And justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Nomi is back tomorrow. The Noma Key Show on YouTube, youtube.com/TheNomaKeyShow. Check that out, folks. Matt, what's happening in the Leckian media universe?
Yeah, this weekend for patrons of Left Reckoning, patreon.com/Left Reckoning, we talked to Wes Cheek about natural disasters, quote, natural disasters, and the phrase building back better. Did you guys know that was a disaster relief phrase? I did not know that that's the context that comes from. Wait,
who are you talking to about that?
Wes Cheek at Wes in Japan. He's a researcher. He formerly at Tulane, now he's in Japan. And we talked to him. He's great on Twitter, also great follow. But we talked to him about how capitalism basically takes advantage of natural disasters.
Wait, wasn't
there was
it
a piece in Current Affairs on that, by the way, just the Build Back Better thing that I did. Go on, Sam.
Wasn't Wes?
He did do that one. Yep.
He gave us the Fukushima updates.
Yep. Yep.
That's when the show launched. Wes became our first, I think, official correspondent.
Oh wow! I didn't even know that. That was before my time.
Unofficial. But we would get updates from him as he was traveling Japan.
Very smart guy.
Very smart. All right, folks. We will see you in the fun half.
Since you left me, want to.